Hey everyone, and welcome to the Sunny Go One Piece podcast. On this episode, we're going to be diving into episodes 502 through 504, which will cover manga chapters 587 through 589. And we reached the climax and tragic conclusion to the Ace Sabo Luffy flashback. But where do we go from here? Alright, so synopsis. With the Great Terminal on fire, Luffy and Ace somehow make it out with the help of Dadang and her gang. But the ensuing days are difficult as we close out this flashback and return to the present. Okay, so differences. There are a few of them. So right off the start, from these, there's a pretty big change with how Dadang shows up in the... In that first, she is revealed grabbing Blue Gem's gun and redirecting the shot on Ace. But in the manga, it jumps straight to her just lunging at him and striking his sword with her axe. So there's that whole gun thing that's basically left out of the manga. There's an extra scene of Luffy trying to leave the house to go look for Ace and Dadang as well. And then there's also an added scene of Sabo walking and being found, whereas in the manga, the next time we see Sabo, he's already in the custody of his father again. Another change that they added was there's a couple moments added between Outlook and Sabo as he hires the officers that captures Sabo to his own personal security detail. And once again, he threatens Sabo with Luffy and Ace's safety, where in the manga, those two parts aren't in there as it goes straight, like simply straight to Outlook, basically telling Sabo that he needs to work to make him and Sabo's mother happy. And so all that stuff about the officers and him threatening Luffy and Ace again, that's all added in the anime. And there are a couple moments after Sabo passes away that Ace and Luffy imagine seeing Sabo encouraging them on. Now, in the anime, there are a couple more instances of these added, but in the manga, it's just the first one. And even then, in the manga, it's just a silhouette of Sabo and not like an actual vision of him like they depict in the anime. So definitely there are a couple changes in regards to sort of the seeing the ghost of Sabo, as you might say. Alrighty, so with that out of the way, let's get into the episodes themselves. So Dadang coming in for the save took me a bit by surprise, but a welcome one for sure. I think it makes perfect sense, and in fact, was probably the next outcome narratively that I thought of. I definitely had her as one of the potential rescuers, but I think I was more fixated on either Sabo or Dragon, as you had just seen them nearby a few scenes ago. And I think that was the intent that Oda was actually going for by having that scene take place just before this one, which is a very tricky and very cheeky move by Oda, I think. But I think it makes sense by this point because Dadang has basically established herself as their surrogate mom. And she is sort of the mama bear ferociously protecting her cubs at this point. And I love how we went from this morally questionable mountain bandit to a woman that would put her life on the line for someone she was willing to let die half a year ago. And her growth and development was really great to see. And the fact that she doesn't fall into any of the usual trappings of like a female character with her, like her design or characterization, both are really awesome and they're very unique compared to all the other female characters that Oda draws. Like, she's strong but feminine, and she doesn't have to be the same sort of female design that Oda gives to everyone in his stories. Also, Dada makes you realize that all this talk about who Luffy's mother is really doesn't matter. In fact, I've never really cared all that much about who Luffy's mother is, because at this point, it's not really anything important as far as I can tell. And as far as I'm concerned, Luffy already has two amazing women in his life that serves as his mother, both Makino and Dadang, in tandem, also kind of with Shanks, Ace, Sabo, and Garp all raise Luffy to be the strong, independent, and kind person he is at the start of the series. And for that, like, I love Dadang. Like, and I've been saying it since the beginning of this flashback that Dadang is one of the unsung heroes, I feel like, of this story that doesn't really get that much credit, I feel like. At least when I, like, see discourse among people across the internet. And I love that after the show of strength and intimidation, Dadang just tells everyone to run, which is the smart thing to do, considering victory in this fight is not necessarily beating Blue Gem, but escaping before the fire engulfs all their escape paths. And this moment is hilarious with the sudden about-face from Delon and the gang, but Ace yet again decides to stubbornly stay and fight this time. Delon, actually taking responsibility for Ace, orders her gang to take Luffy and themselves to safety while she stays behind for Ace. We unfortunately don't get to see what happens with that until later. But the next scene is one I kind of talked about in the last podcast episode, actually. And it's the moment where Dragon and the Revolutionary Army come in to save the people of the Great Terminal. This moment definitely lends more credence to the theory that Dragon is a Devil Fruit user, as he uses a massive blast of wind and blows a path through the fire to allow the trapped people to get to the safety of their ship. And we also get to see Ivankov and Kuma as part of the Revolutionary Army here as well. Now, the whole town is excited to welcome a celestial dragon. And in the manga, this was actually told to us much earlier in the flashback, pretty much right after Luffy, Ace, and Sabo become friends. It was weirdly told to us by the narrator all that time ago. And it's at this time that Sabo unfortunately decides to set off on his dream of sailing the seas to become a pirate, as he can't let another moment of him being locked up pass him by. Sabo steals a small fishing chip and sets out, but as he's passing by the world government ship, the celestial dragon named St. Jalmak fires upon Sabo's ship for perceived disrespect. And there's a couple things about this moment that came to mind, especially on rewatch. First is, why is St. Jalmak even here? Like, what reason would a celestial dragon have for coming to a small nation like the Goa Kingdom? And I don't think this was ever revealed to my knowledge, either now or in a future episode. Now, here's my theory why he might be here. So I think the Goa Kingdom could have been one of the original 20 kingdoms that made up the world government 800 years ago when it first formed. And perhaps St. Jalmak's family were the original royal family that were from and ruled the Goa Kingdom before leaving to become a celestial dragon up in Marijua. So he might be here to check up on his kingdom, and that's really the only reason I can think of that he'd come all this distance, you know, for a country that's not of really any great significance, at least at this time. Of course, this island will eventually go on to be the birthplace of Ace, Luffy, Dragon, and Garp, all who, aside from Garp, will go on to be infamous around the world. But of course, Garp is also very well known as a marine hero, so it's actually going to eventually get a lot of people who have some sort of a famous lineage coming from this island. A couple other interesting notes in comparison to the celestial dragons that we saw in Sabaody is how the citizens of Goa Kingdom not only welcome the celestial dragons, but seem to genuinely be excited about it and highlighting how little exposure they've had with them, because the citizens of Sabaody react incredibly differently to the celestial dragons there. As we saw, anytime they came, everyone was shaking in their boots in abject terror in their presence, and this is probably because being so close to Marijua and the location of a well-known slave auction, they were there frequently enough that people saw the true horror of these people. Another small minor detail is that you'll notice that Jalmak is wearing a rectangular helmet apparatus, unlike St. Charles and the other Roswald members we saw in Sabaody wearing the bubble-shaped ones, and that's probably due to the fact that the Sabaody bubbles are only useful near Sabaody, as stated by Hachi when Luffy wanted the bubble bike. But also, I don't know, in later instances, we do see other sort of celestial dragons have the round bubble helmets as well. So I don't know if this is just a stylistic choice from St. Jalmak to wear a rectangular one to differentiate himself, but yeah, I noticed it was really weird because I think he's the only one we do actually see wearing the square ones. Or perhaps maybe the rectangular ones are like the old style, and so like the modern ones, they use the bubble ones. I don't know. It's just a really weird detail. But after a couple days, Ace and Dadan are able to make it back and finally get to see what became of the confrontation between Blue Jam, Ace, and Dadan. And this is where Dadan really shows just how amazing of a person she is now and how much she's come to embrace being a guardian and a parent to these kids. Like, she freaking risks her life to run through fire to make a path for Ace, and Ace in turn stays behind to nurse Dadan back to a point where at least he can carry her back to the cabin. Coming full circle where at the start they both hated but kind of tolerated each other, And it's just another amazing example of Oda sort of endearing us to a character we had no business getting invested with. And Dadan, I feel like, is super underrated too, like I mentioned. And yeah, she's just rarely ever talked about for being such a cool character. Then we get the huge moment where it all comes together when it comes to how Ace thinks and why that pivotal moment happened the way it did back on Marineford. So Dadan finally asks the question everyone wanted to know, why didn't Ace run? And while he does admit that some of it is his emotions getting the better of him, but this is, you know, this particular time, it was because Luffy was behind him. We then get a further elaboration from Garp in a mini flashback where Garp talks about the same quality that Roger had. And I like the way he puts it. It's not that they're running. It's more that they're preventing their enemies from escaping. And Roger hated seeing his loved ones disrespected or hurt and would always stand by and protect them. And for that reason, Garp came to respect Roger for being that straightforward and sincere about the way he lived his life. And I also love that little joke at the end where he tells Dadan, and that's why I chose to take care of Ace. And then she claps back, we're the ones who took him in and take care of him. And Garp's like, huh? I don't know, that scene always kind of gave me a chuckle. But yeah, there it is. The true reason why Ace stayed behind to face Akainu. It wasn't because he was thinking irrationally or being prideful, although Ace made it seem like it was about that. But in reality, he stayed behind because he felt that if he didn't stay behind, that it would put Luffy at more risk, and he wanted to make sure that Luffy survived as his older brother, like we mentioned. In Japanese culture, the duties of an older brother go above and beyond, and Ace takes this very seriously. And you know what? When you look at it from this perspective, Ace was right, because what happens just seconds after Ace turned around to face off against Akainu? Luffy's strength finally gave out and he couldn't even walk anymore due to all that he put his body through with the adrenaline shots and the gear second use. This is a point I often see people miss when they criticize Ace for being quote-unquote stupid for staying behind and getting baited by Akainu. Ace knew exactly what he was doing and he knew the risks, but it didn't matter. Ace was already fulfilled in his purpose in life at that moment because he got what he wanted. A family that genuinely loved him and wanted him. So for him, he had to make sure the living embodiment of that dream, who was Luffy, had survived. And the first person he ever met that genuinely said that they wanted Ace to be a part of their life, and in fact, not just wanted, but needed Ace, was Luffy. So yeah, all in all, yeah, there may have been a possibility where had Ace kept running that they both could have made it out, but I think Ace making the decision to guarantee that Luffy made it out at the risk of his own life, I think you can kind of make sense of why he did what he did. Then you think Luffy's past was sad enough with the whole Shanks thing and losing his arm, but it goes from sad to horrifying as Dogura comes back to relay the news that Sabo was in fact killed by the Celestial Dragon. And I legit tear up every time they read Sabo's letter. And I think it just hurts so much because you realize just how much all three have been through despite their young age. And this really hits hard when you see Ace finally able to let his emotions out for the first time, even though it's in private. And that buildup of seeing a character that has always just acted tough and unemotional apart from anger makes this moment very hard-hitting and emotional. It's kind of amazing that this kid eventually grew up to become Ace, the Ace that we know and love in the present, because, you know, in the present, Ace has such a sunny and polite disposition. And up until now, we've only seen one that's very sort of bitter at the world and angry all the time. And I think definitely Sabo and Luffy were the turning point for that. And this was definitely one of the biggest ones. The next scene hurts so much because of not only the fact that this scene retroactively makes Luffy's two failures in the present hurt that much more, and that's Luffy saying that he wants to get more and more and more strength and asks Ace not to die. And you begin to understand even more how hard those two moments were because they call directly back to the trauma of losing Sabo. We even saw when Kuma was standing over Luffy on Sabaody, Luffy writhing on the ground yelling that he was too weak yet again. And Luffy found himself too weak to save the ones he cared for the most. And then to follow that moment up, Luffy also mentions that here he doesn't want Ace to die, and yet again he was too weak to save Ace as well. And this just basically reminds him of his greatest failure, and that nothing has changed, which is why Luffy has broken down basically in the present. I mean, for Luffy, this was literally the worst outcome he could have ever envisioned. The concept and goal of becoming free, the freest person in the world, was most likely ingrained in him here after seeing Sabo die from being oppressed and abused. Whether it was a retcon or not, I love that there is a reason for why both Ace and Luffy left their journey at the age of 17. It was not just some arbitrary number, it was in remembrance of Sabo and the idea that he wanted to leave before he became officially a nobleman at the age of 18. One other thing that I wanted to mention is, you know how I talked about the one other early hint that Sabo existed was Ace's tattoo? Well, in this episode, we finally can put the dots together and realize that his tattoo wasn't just a gag of Ace accidentally tattooing his name incorrectly. It was actually in honor of his late brother Sabo, as we see Sabo's pirate flag and his signature is the S with the crossbones. And there is even sort of a confirmation of this from Oda, because Oda drew an alternate universe chapter cover in chapter 596 where Sabo never died, and Ace's tattoo is spelled correctly with just A-C-E. And there's also a couple sort of dream shorts, as I think they're referred to, where we see the events of Marineford play out, but in a reality where Sabo had lived and comes in to save both Ace and Luffy from Akainu. It's just a short 3-chapter special series published in the, I believe it was published in the One Piece magazine. And the little 3-chapter short was called Luff, as in Luffy, but without the Y. And it was actually written by Oda himself, so this was his interpretation of those events had Sabo lived. It's pretty interesting. I mean, there's not really too much to it other than Sabo comes in and kind of whisks them away. But it is pretty cool to see Oda doing sort of like Marvel what-ifs. Speaking of what-ifs, there was a time where I thought maybe this flashback would have been better had we been shown this before Ace's death to give it more of an impact and for us to get more attached to Ace. And so when Ace ultimately did die, I think it would have had a bit more impact. But I think had Oda done that, it would have made it way too obvious that Ace was going to die. But by reversing it, I think he chose the sort of the quote-unquote lesser of two evils by preserving the complete shock and devastation of when Ace did ultimately meet his end. Yet we still can go back and learn more about who Ace is as a character. And retroactively, that scene becomes even more devastating. Kind of moving on to the next section of the story. However, in the first scene of episode 504, we basically get a pretty good idea that Sabo was in fact still alive. Although it's never outright stated, but putting all the context clues here together, it's pretty obvious. In sort of like classic Oda fashion, we never actually see Sabo physically die. And now that dragon is seemingly carrying someone with grave injuries, this is most likely Sabo that needs care. And we also see that the Revolutionary Army stopped off at Shimotsuki Village, where we see Kuina and Zoro training as well as kids. And we also see that, or I guess we hear that Kozaburo gave them some food for their trip back to Baltiago. Of course, this raises so many questions about if Sabo is in fact alive, where has he been this whole time? And what, you know, why didn't he try and come save Luffy and Ace? Now, I don't want to get into that here, as there will be plenty of time to sort of bring up those sort of questions later on. But yeah, it is interesting. I don't know if Oda meant for this to be a mystery, because it's pretty damn obvious. I don't think anyone for a minute thought that Sabo was actually dead after seeing this scene. But with Sabo gone, it's really wonderful to see Ace begin to realize that it really is his sole responsibility to look after Luffy now and fulfill Sabo's last request to take care of their little brother. When Ace falls back into his kind of his loner habits and lets Luffy get injured by the bear, it really hits him just what that really means to be a big brother. And this is where we see Ace start to genuinely work on bettering himself, not for his sake necessarily, but for Luffy's sake. He asks Makino to help learn manners so that one day he can go thank Shanks for saving his brother, which we did see in the Ace and Whitebeard flashback. And I think this whole thing is so sweet, including the montage of them growing up and getting closer than ever over the years, until 7 years later when Ace turns 17 and can finally set out on his journey. It's a really cool sort of growth. Unfortunately, we don't get to see most of it. Where we see the ill-tempered Ace go to the bright and shiny, like, happy Ace that we see. But just when you think Dadan wasn't at Ace's farewell, she is actually the one taking it the hardest. And I love that she's basically grown herself fully into becoming their mother. And like I've been saying, it is such an underrated character and story. She also has an equally heartfelt yet hilarious send-off for Luffy as well. And when it's his turn, we finally get to see Luffy set off on his journey. And I love that the fisherman is like, take my boat instead of that small boat. It's going to sink immediately. And of course, it does sink shortly after he sets off, as we saw at the beginning of the series. And one really cool thing about this flashback is that we finally get to see the moment where Luffy knocks out the Lord of the Coast. Yes, that very same one that attacked him as a kid and ate Shanks' arm. This was actually in the manga in chapter 1. But for some reason, it was cut out of the anime at the very beginning. However, for anime-only watchers, it's pretty cool to see it here for the first time, since this is the real first Gomu Gomu no pistol that has so much... It creates so much more weight to it after seeing Luffy try and perfect it for like 10 years. And now that he's got one successfully that he can shoot off, and the first one we do see is him knocking out the same one that terrified him as a kid. Of course, we've all seen this scene in We Are. Like, it's in the theme song. In fact, it's so vividly clear because it makes that sound effect whenever it plays the theme song. But yeah, it's nice to see it properly actually in the story. The flashback ends on the same upbeat and hopeful note that the series started all the way back in Chapter 1 or Episode 4. But when we cut back to the present, Luffy is just reminded of just how weak he still is. And this moment really puts Luffy into perspective. Like, it wasn't that long ago Luffy felt like he was a weak crybaby trying to follow in his cooler, stronger, older brother's footsteps. And this sort of ultra-confident, monstrously strong and upbeat guy has dealt with a lot of trauma already in his life. And it really paints Luffy in a new light in that... And I know... I felt like I've been kind of taking Luffy for granted in the terms of like who he is and the way he is. Like, this all just came naturally to him, and I'm sure it is very natural to him to stay upbeat and confident, but at the same time, Luffy has had to struggle and work for things, and a lot of the things he's had to work for. And for the first time ever, we see Luffy lose that unwavering belief in himself, and he failed to do the one thing he promised himself he would do. But not only was he still too weak to protect his crew, but he feels like he let another brother die because he was too weak. And Luffy is now brought down to his lowest moment. Like, he seemingly lost everything and has been torn down, completing sort of that arc of discovering his weaknesses and also failing. But it will be interesting to see how Luffy bounces back and overcomes this tremendous loss, because we know he will. But I like that Oda chose to basically strip down Luffy and just deconstruct him to this level before we can build him back up. The next episode is one of my all-time favorite episodes in the series because of its sheer emotional resonance and quite possibly one of the most used quotes from One Piece in my life. It has saved me so many times in my life and has given me perspective on a great number of things, and I honestly can't wait to talk about this episode because it's definitely one that I've been looking forward to talking about for a while now because of just how important this episode is, not only to the series, but to me personally. But anyways, if you did enjoy this, send me a like or comment. And if you want to join me on this journey of rewatching One Piece, please consider subscribing. Check out my Instagram and Twitter account at SunnyGoPodcast for updates on when I post new episodes and to see some pictures of my manga collection. And as always, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to listen to my podcast. It's going to be a small spoiler section just to talk about a few things. But if you're not interested in that, stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the next episode. Bye! Alright, so spoiler section. Really, the only thing I wanted to actually talk about with this spoiler section is the fact that Sabo kind of refers to the Goa Kingdom as a birdcage, which is actually... obviously it's not intentional, but it's a nice foreshadow of when the next time we actually do see him is in Dressrosa, where Doflamingo actually encases the city, a celestial dragon, mind you, in a literal birdcage, and now he has to help Luffy and everyone else liberate the city of Dressrosa from this birdcage. So I always thought that was a really funny line that I don't know if it was intentional. I don't think it was intentional, but it was just like a nice little symmetry in that regard, you know, the whole George Lucas, it's like poetry, it rhymes kind of way. And so, yeah, I don't know. I just kind of noticed that quote this time around after having seen Dressrosa. And so, yeah, I just kind of wanted to mention that because I thought it was a really fun reference. But yeah, beyond that, I don't really have too much in the way of spoilers. I know there's a lot that we could talk about when it comes to Sabo and the fact that obviously he does return in Dressrosa. You know what's funny though? One thing I guess I will kind of talk about in my own personal experience, even though I knew Sabo was still alive and somewhere out there, it caught me by complete surprise when he did actually show up in Dressrosa. Like, I think my reaction was literally Luffy's reaction when he saw Sabo, because I didn't think that Sabo would actually return for a while, to be honest, and I didn't know what capacity he would return in. But yeah, I was actually still caught off guard by that reveal. Of course, there's a lot of criticism when it comes to Sabo's sort of place in the story. A lot of people just see it as another ace, like he basically just replaced Ace, which is true. I mean, he basically does fulfill the role of Ace in the post-time skip era, even right down to the fact that he also gets the Mana no Mi and has the fire powers. But I don't know. I don't necessarily have an issue with that. I like the fact that just when Ace left the story, then, you know, a little while later, Sabo comes in to sort of basically be that support system for Luffy. And so I like the fact that Sabo is still alive and in the story, even though they play very similar roles in sort of the context of Luffy's character arc. But yeah, I don't really have an issue with it. But that's pretty much all I really wanted to talk about here in the spoiler section. So thanks for listening to me sort of just ramble on, and I hope to see you in the next episode. See ya.